Okay. So, hello everyone. I'm Vincent Verdi from the Observatory of Paris. So I'm an astrophysicist. And today I will present something about how can we simulate the process in the universe using modern C++. So in this talk, there will be a few parts of C++ only, but the main part of the talk will be how can we use the tools provided by C++ in order to make softwares in a good way, in order to make simulations or physics, chemistry, or climatology, science. So another title for this talk would be, could have been current problems of software design in scientific domains that rely heavily on high performance computing and how modern C++ can be just the right tool to solve them. And if we focus on scientific domains, I think that all what I will say in this talk can be applied to astrophysics, climatology, fluid dynamics, mechanics, physics, biology, and chemistry. So this talk will be about C++, a lot of software design, science, of course, high performance computing and supercomputers. If we have supercomputers, then we have to do parallelism. Template metaprogramming, because in order to achieve the best performance possible, the best possible performance, template metaprogramming can be a very, very useful tool. And how to achieve genericity and efficiency thanks to C++. And for those who like buzzwords, it will talk also about exascale, which is the fact to compute 10 to the 18 operation per second, and big data. So in order to present the context, I will explain what is cosmology just in a few minutes, in order for you to know what I will try to achieve. So I'm sorry because there will be some physics, but you will see it will be simple. So thanks to general relativity, Albert Einstein told us that the space-time geometry is related to the space-time contents. So if you have matter in the universe, and we have matter in the universe, it will modify the geometry of space-time. And in physics, you can write that with tensors, which are the two matrices that you can see here. So if we have a massive object, as I said, it will deform the space-time. And so it will deform the space-time for the Earth, but for the Sun and for the universe itself. So as always in physics, if we want to study the universe in a whole, we will try to simplify this because it's very difficult to solve in a general way. So in order to study the whole universe, we apply two principles. The first one is that at large scale, the universe is homogeneous. And the second one is that at large scale, the universe is isotropic. So it is the same in all directions. And then your matrices is only diagonal. So you have only four terms. And if furthermore you consider that your universe can be parameterized by fluids, your T mu nu, which is this matrix, have only a pressure and rho a density. And then you can start to think about how the universe evolved within this formalism. So it is a little technical, but if we make the calculation in cosmology, we can show that all the evolution of the universe, if we consider that it is homogeneous and isotropic, can be written in a single equation, where omega r is the radiation, m is for matter, lambda is for the energy of the vacuum, and a is the distance between two galaxies. And cosmology is only that when we talk about homogeneous cosmology. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that how?
It's how is the dynamic of the universe. So how it will evolve in time. So how it will evolve in time will be only related to the density of radiation, matter, and vacuum. So then you can try to put some values for the different omega, and it will tell you how the universe will expand. So for example, if you have a lot of, if you put only matter, then you will have one of these curves. An abscissae, you have the age of the universe, and the other axis, you have the distance between two galaxies. So in the past, you have a size of zero, which is the Big Bang. And in 1997, we had an observational confirmation of the expansion of the universe. And that's all for cosmology. Cosmology, homogeneous cosmology, is only that. But in fact, there are two fundamental open problems. The first one. The first one is if you look to galaxies. So galaxies are made of a lot of stars, and you can compute the rotational speed of the galaxy in two ways. First, you can observe the star and make a theoretical prediction. Here, you have the distance from the center of the galaxy to the edge, and here you have the velocity. So you have a theoretical prediction, and if you make the observation, you have the other curve. You have a difference, and currently we don't explain from where this difference occurs. So a first approach would be to suppose that you have dark matter, so supplementary matter that you can't observe, and another possibility is to modify the general relativity. So this is the first open problem. The second open problem is the acceleration of the expansion of the universe, because if you look to the distance of supernova, you realize that the universe, in the recent history, the universe expands itself more rapidly than it should be. So you can make several observations, several type of observation, and every observation will tell you that the universe is growing more and more rapidly. And this is not predicted by the homogeneous cosmology with only matter. And in this context, you can have also two main approaches. First, you can suppose that the energy of vacuum is not null, or that general relativity should be modified. So this is the current context of cosmology. How can we test our models? If we observe the universe, here we are at the center, and you observe every galaxy that you can have access with telescopes, you see that the galaxies are not distributed randomly. And if you, in this plot, every point is a single galaxy. So the universe is not strictly homogeneous. And one way to constrain model is to study what are the imprints of the cosmology on the structuration, so on galaxies. And in the opposite, what is the cosmology? What can I infer from cosmology using the structuration of the universe? And that's where numerical cosmology happen. So in physics, when you have a complex system like that, or nonlinear processes, you can use numerical simulations. There are two ways two ways numerical in which numerical simulation can help. The first one is by considering numerical simulation as computer-assisted theory. So numerical simulation will only be like a giant calculator, if you will. And the second way is to consider numerical simulation as numerical experiment. In reality, we can consider that experiments and observation is something by which we can make experimental measure from nature. And simulation are just the exact same thing, but for theory. So theory is a model for nature. And by doing simulation, we can make numerical measures. So if we want to study what is the link between cosmology and the structuration of the universe, we will try to make simulation of large-scale structures. So first, at very, very large scale, we will consider that gravity is completely dominant and all gas physics and all of that can be neglected. Second remark, in order to make this kind of simulation, we will consider n-body objects. And we'll try to see how these bodies are interacting. So to make this kind of simulation, we need a cosmological model, so homogeneous like I presented before. It will give us the speed rate, the rate of the expansion. Then we'll consider matter particles in a simulation box. So the more particle you have, the better precision you have. You will take initial conditions for these particles that are compatible with observations. Then you will need a solver. In the next part, I will explain a little what is a solver and how we treat the n-body problem. And finally, a supercomputer. And to solve all of this, we use a lot of our codes are based on adaptive mesh refinement, which is simply in order to compute all the forces, you divide a box in cubic cells, and the better precision you want, the more cell you have. So if we take all of this, then we can make a numerical simulation of formation of large-scale structure. So at the beginning of the simulation, we have something that is quite homogeneous, like the universe at its beginning. And we let it evolve. Here, each point is a galaxy. And then we see that the galaxy attract each other and form filaments. So you have the time, here it is at 5 billion years ago. And by detecting the properties of the large scale structures, so the group of galaxies and supercluster filaments, we can then try to test our cosmological models, because several cosmological models we lead to different kind of structuration. So we have this simulation, but if we consider that supercomputers will evolve since the 70s, in the beginning. What can we do with better supercomputers? Because we have already big simulation, but what can we do with more powerful supercomputers? One first possibility is to continue to do the same physics. With the same physics, with additional power, we may want to explore the parameter space, so several kind of cosmological models or things like that. We may want to increase the size of or the resolution. So in this approach, we will make big simulation or very detailed simulations. Or we may want to enhance statistical properties by making many small simulations. Another possibility is to improve physics. So you will put all physics that you want in this simulation, but some people do that, but in my opinion, it's as long as you continue to put physics, it becomes more and more difficult to interpret the result of your simulations. And another approach would be to consider simpler but more fundamental physics. And in this approach, the goal is to understand the emergence of the macroscopic law in physics. For example, in this approach, you can try to simulate a material by only considering particle physics. And then you can understand how particle physics will lead to macroscopic law in materials. In the next part of the talk, I will focus on this part because we had the chance to realize a kind of simulation on a whole supercomputer with this approach. So what would be the maximum size we can reach? In fact, the maximal interesting size that we can reach with cosmological simulation is the size of the entire observable universe. And in fact, with petascale computers, with a resolution of approximately one particle for one galaxy, we can make simulation of the whole observable universe. So we made this simulation in 2012. It cost 50 million computing hours on a whole machine of 80,000 cores. We had 300 terabytes of memory, of RAM. And at the end, we stored 1.6 petabytes of data. So during the run itself, there was a lot more data. 1.6 petabytes are only the interesting physical data at the end of the run. In this simulation, the n of which stays in n body was 550 billion particles. And we are only interested in very large scale properties, so we don't want to simulate each galaxy. We just want to see how the filaments and the galaxy interact with each other. But it was not done in C++, it was done with Fortran 90. But during that, we realized that all codes we use in astrophysics, a lot of code we use in astrophysics, have their own limits, particularly in terms of design and architectures. So we learned a lot of things by doing the simulations. So why should the astrophysics community should consider C++? I will try to detail why. So first, for exascale, we have some expectation for 2020 to be able to make very big simulations. But one problem currently is that we have very large code base and with people who are not expert in programming. And so as the simulation becomes more and more complex, it's more and more difficult to understand everything in this kind of code. Second goal is big data. In physics, we produce a lot of data. It's very easy to produce with a telescope or with a simulation. But the danger with that is we may end with a big cemetery of data because there are only few people out there that will be able to analyze this data. And it's a risk if we don't have the correct tools to analyze this kind of results. So before going to C++, I have some preliminary remarks. First, computing is now everywhere in physics. So even if I am a physicist, I use programming in daily basis for simulation. Other people can use it for experimental analysis, for observation, etc. So we have a lot of codes out there for physics, but most physicists are self-taught programmers, even if scientific programming is one of their main activities. So you have a huge code base developed with a lot of copy and paste, a lot of a bad practice, because it's research, so we need to modify our code on a daily basis. But you have, for big programs, you end up with like monsters, something like monsters that are very difficult to maintain. And the team that maintain this kind of codes are small teams. In fact, for big codes in the community, you have in general less than 10 developers. And as I said before, with these codes, we can produce a lot of data. So if you ask people in the astrophysical community, how can we prepare exascale, they will tell you the following things. We may want to adapt existing code to new architecture, use more and more hardware-dependent tricks. We may want to develop new parallelization techniques or new numerical methods. Or we may want to implement new physics or develop new pre- and post-processing codes. But if you ask how, they will tell you that, as usual, by improving existing code, optimizing them, and adapting them for specific architectures. But in fact, all of these things, they rely on a very basic thing, which is software development. So before going to exascale, we may want to look of our kind of development we are currently making, what are their problems, and how can we improve them. So the full universe one can tell us that we will probably can't achieve exascale computing by reconsidering our way of making codes. So our goal is to achieve both genericity and efficiency. The full universe one tells us also that exascale is very different from exaflop. In fact, if we consider two supercomputers, one in 2004 and one in 2014, the flops per second were multiplied by 1,000, but the memory by only 100 and storage by 10. So all aspects doesn't scale in the same manner. So we will have more and more power, CPU power, but it may not be the case for memory and storage. So we can say that the full lunch is over, memory efficiency and data locality will become more and more critical in the coming years. And if flop continues to scale in that way, computing will become free compared to transfer cost. So there is a lot of attention that should be put in the algorithm and in the data locality of our algorithm. So how can we improve the way we make astrophysical software? First, we have to consider the architecture of current supercomputers. So a supercomputer is a big computer with several nodes. In every node, you have a motherboard with one or several CPUs. In each CPU, you have several cores. with one or some vectorization unit. And for each CPU, you can have also an extension card, which can be a CPU or a mini core card. And creating software to achieve the best performance on all these aspects can be very difficult. It can be difficult because optimization for this kind of architecture are dependent of the architecture. In fact, when you do a simulation, you have four main numerical aspects. The first aspect is computation time, so pure CPU time. Second one is communication. Third one, memory usage, and inputs and outputs. And when you arrive in a supercomputer, you realize that each architecture has its own limits. So if I consider one particular supercomputer, I will have this kind of limit. And consider that my goal is to make a simulation that will occupy that will need this resource of computation compared to the 100% of the machine, this need of communication, this need of memory, and this need of input and output. If my code is too intensive from the point of view of computation, I may want to transfer computation to memory and I/O. For example, if I have one code which computes a lot of numbers, I can optimize it by transferring some of the computation to memory by storing the numbers, storing temporary numbers, or by writing some of the numbers on the storage. So this is a first type of optimization, which can be described as a trading between trading between computation and memory and I/O. It's very easy to do so. Another kind of optimization is to reduce all the requirements of your code, and when you want to transform that to that, then you have to make architecture dependent optimizations. So every code then, when you make this kind of things, every code will be characteristic particular of one type of machine. So now you have optimized your code and you look at your simulation code. In fact, currently simulation code, they try to solve a given physical problems and they do it well, but they are very difficult to modify. If you consider libraries, they are passive, you just call functions. You call basic functions and the library will not modify your code. I will show that the classical approach has four main fundamental problems, and I will show that it is possible with C++ to do it differently. So the first problem is intertwining. If I consider a simulation code, generally I will have these things, which is there will be a timeline of physics put in big numerical methods and a lot of code to do parallelization, and all is intertwined. So with this kind of software architecture, it's impossible to just write physics, because if you just want to modify physics, you need to know what the numerical methods are and what the parallelization techniques are. And to avoid that, people tend to use extensively copy and paste when they want to modify things in their code. When you have such a thing, it's very difficult to have a proper version management. Because, in fact, if you have a main research group that develop its version, and if you have several groups that fork from this main version and implement their own physics method or optimization in different orders, then it's very difficult to merge them at the end, and you, because the changes are non-commutative. It's not the same thing to first change the method and then the physics. So changing the method and then the physics is different from changing the physics and then the method. So you end up with an increasing number of specialized versions and an extensive use of copy-paste to solve this kind of problem. Third problem, expertise. If you have these kind of things, the problem is that you can't benefit from the expertise of everyone, because every single person that wants to modify the code have to have a global vision of the simulation code. So at the end of the day, people need to be expert in everything in order to modify your code. It's hard to benefit from the expertise of specialized people, let's say someone who has a very good knowledge in many cores. And with this kind of thing, it's very difficult to manage the increasing heterogeneity of supercomputers, because you need a deep technical understanding before modifying physics. All of this will lead to this thing. We can ask this question: how does the code itself scale? So if I have a given number of data types, a given number of algorithms, a given number of architectures, if I want to achieve the best possible performance, I will have to multiply these terms and to write every possible versions in order to get the best possible performance. For example, if I have two data types, three algorithms, and if I want to target three kind of architectures, I will end up with approximately 18 more lines than for a single version. So you have two solutions. The first one is to hire an army of developers to code all possibilities. Or the second one, which is each research group will only implement what they need. And as in research, one is not possible, you will lose efficiency, because the production scales linearly at a given number of developers, whereas the theoretical number of lines of code you would need to explore all the possibilities will explode. So to solve this problem, one approach would be object-oriented programming, which is not used currently in science code. So you come to people and you explain them what is object-oriented. And for example, if you have a particle, you may want to generalize this particle in order to have several versions and to be able to achieve generosity in your code. So you just change, in order to do that, the first step is to add a virtual destructor. But the problem is that by doing so with a simulation of 550 billion particles, you have just slot 4 terabytes of virtual pointers by just adding a virtual destructor. Because when you have a virtual destructor, you have virtual pointers, and then when you have many of these kind of objects, you lose, in this case, 4 terabytes of virtual pointers. So in high performance computing, object-oriented programming and runtime polymorphism is sometimes not an option, because you have an indirection overhead, and what you want to have is maximal performance, and you have a memory overhead. So if object-oriented C++ is not the good thing, maybe generic programming is a good approach. Because what we want to do is to transform this scalability of the source line of code into this kind of things. If I have two data types, three algorithms, and three architectures, I just want to write one function for each part of my code. So to go from the first line to the second, it's like an optimizing an algorithm. But here, it's for the number of lines of codes. And this is a typical job of a compiler, because the compiler is assembling your code puzzle from all independent parts. It is choosing the best solution available. It optimizes it, and it generates an executable. So let's code a compiler for our domain of research. So to code a compiler, you have three solutions. The first one is to define a new language. So in this case, domain-specific language. For example, for producing documents, you have LaTeX. For internet, for website, you can have PHP. These things are domain-specific language. So they are very good on one particular purpose. You can code a precompiler or a code translator, which take your code and convert it to another language. So it allows to put specific extension for your particular domain. And the third solution is the embedded domain-specific language, which allows you to code a domain-specific language, so a language for your domain of application, inside another language. So every approach has his advantage and drawbacks. But if you want to produce code that can be read by non-domain experts and that can achieve maximum performance, the third one is preferable. Because for people that will use your code, it seems like a library. But in fact, in the compilation process, you can make a lot of things. And here comes C++, because in fact there are two languages that in which you can execute programs in the compiler, C++ and D. And this is just the right solution for scientific computing, because you will be able to achieve generosity and maximum performance. And in C++, you will use template. You can use template metaprogramming, expression templates, constant expression programming. You can use lambda expression, and with all of that, you will be able to create active libraries that will modify the user code and generate the best possible executable. Using these techniques, you will be able to separate all the problems. You will be able to code parallelization, numerical method, and physics independently, and the compiler will take all of that, mix that, and generate the best possible executable. So using these techniques allow to solve the four problems with a minimum cost for the user, but a certain cost for the library developer. Because after that, you have dissociated every aspect. The library modifications are now commutative. You can use the best expertise on every aspect. And now the number of lines of codes scaled as a sum of the different terms, and not as a multiplication. So for our particular domain of application, when we may want to make n-dimensional interpolation in a generic way. Currently, if I take an existing code, a probable approach that I will see in this code is that the developers have hardly coded every possible number of dimensions, number of type of particles, every type of cells. For example, if you have cells with temperature, density, and others with temperature, density, gravitational potential, people tend to write every single version, even if the logic is the same. But by using C++ and template metaprogramming, you can code this kind of things one time and only one time, and the code will be generated for an arbitrary number of dimensions, for an arbitrary type of cell, and with an arbitrary type of particle. So you will specify before compiling your program the number of dimensions, the type of cell, and the type of particle, and the compiler will take care of that for you. So I will not go deep in the details, but to achieve this kind of things, you have three basic techniques. The first one is template metaprogramming, and now constant expression computation. You have CRTP for curiously recurring template pattern, which is a specific pattern used a lot in template metaprogramming to inject code in existing classes, and Sphinae to control the indentation process. These are basic techniques from the point of view of template metaprogramming, but with that you can make your code more generic and more performant. So in C++ 11, we have a new tool which are constant expression, and we may want to know what kind of should I choose template metaprogramming or constant expression metaprogramming. A good test in order to know what are the difference between the two is to compute the Ackermann function in the compiler. So the Ackermann function is a purely a recursive function which has some explosive properties, and it can be write only like that. And we will compare the performance of the runtime computation, template metaprogramming computation, and constant expression computation. So with this definition, if I want to compute the Ackermann function at runtime, the code is only that. So if m is equal to 0, then I return n plus 1. If n equal to 0, then I call recursively the Ackermann function with m minus 1. And in any other case, I call run Ackermann with m minus 1 and the Ackermann function itself with m and n minus 1. In template metaprogramming, so using structures, I can do the same thing with specialization. So it's exactly the same thing, but with structures and constant value, static constant value. And I can do the same with constant expression. So the first line, the first function is actually computing recursively the Ackermann function. And here, the other function, meta Ackermann, is just ensuring that the computation is done at compile time with an integral constant. So then I can compare the several approach. So I compile with GCC. In fact, it doesn't work with Intel, neither with LLVM, because the recursion is going too far. And I obtain the following results. So I've put the compilation time and the execution time. So at runtime, for the run Ackermann function, I got an execution time of about 3 seconds. If I try to do that with template metaprogramming, then the 3 seconds of execution time are converted to 37 seconds at compile time. So the compiler tried to compute that function by implementing a lot of structures, and the total time are 37 seconds. And using constant expression, then the compilation time is only 0.6 seconds. So it means that the compiler can compute the Ackermann function by constant expression more rapidly than the runtime version of the Ackermann function. So in that case, that means that the compiler with constant expressions can compute things by optimizing trees very rapidly. So if you want to compute quantities, instead of using template metaprogramming, now you can use constant expression metaprogramming. The second technique, which can be used a lot, is the curiously recurring template pattern. So I suppose that you know what it is. If you don't know, it's just a pattern that allows to derive a class from a base class in which you specify the template parameter as the derivative class. And it allows to achieve static polymorphism. And contrary to object-oriented programming at runtime. And by doing so, you can avoid virtual pointers, virtual destructors, and this kind of things, and do the same thing, but all at compile time. By doing so, you can achieve very good performance for high-performance computing. The last one is Sphinae. So Sphinae allow you to control the instantiation process. So in this example, I want two functions f. This one will be executed if the type can be serialized through the output operator. And the first one will be instantiated if the type have a serialized version. So by doing this kind of things and using the new C++11 enable if utility, you can control exactly what is done in your compilation process. In this case, if I want if an object has both this operator, the output operator, and the serialized function, then these dummy parameters using the dot 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 notation will specify a lower priority than the first function. So in that case, the compiler will begin to implement, will start by trying the first version. If your object has the both serialized and operator output function, it will implement the first one. If you don't put the dummy dot 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 thing, then you will have a conflict. So by using all this technique, you can redesign astrophysical codes as they exist currently. So if you look at astrophysical code and you try to design an abstraction, you will have two types of quantities. We will have Eulerian quantities, which are basically cells with quantity like temperature or pressure, and you will have Lagrangian quantities, which are particles, and that move through your cells. Then you can design your software in four different levels. Here I call the level zero utilities, so files to C++ file to manage your code, to implement parallelization, to log, to compute time, etc., etc. Then you will have a level one part. A level two part, which is, so the first one is for static aspect, the second one is for cinematic aspect, and the third one is for dynamic aspect. So the static aspects concern static Eulerian and static Lagrangian quantity. So it's basically all the things that concern trees or interpolators. The second aspect, the second level is when you have static Eulerian, so you have a fixed grid, and in that grid, you have particles that go through that grid. So in that part, you will have to code integrators. And finally, the complete thing with dynamic particles and dynamic cells. So if you want to make a whole simulation with that, with everything changing at each step, we'll have to code this third level of refinement. So if I focus on the first level, one thing that I have in all, in mainly all astrophysical codes, are octree and trees. So the kind of tree we use are octrees, which are these kind of things. So the generalization of octrees are O3. And every time you want more precision and more resolution, you divide your cell in 8 cells. Okay, so you end up with a big data structure in which every node can be divided in nothing or in 8 cells. And to optimize parallelization of this kind of octree, we use space filling curves, which are curves like that that fill all the space, and which have properties like contiguity, and allow you to put all contiguous cells on the same process. So it avoids to have two processes that are neighbors to share very distant cells. So the current implementation of this kind of trees are for 2D and 3D only, if you look to most of the codes in astrophysics. There is no generosity of contents, there is a large memory footprint, and you have indirection because they are trees, so they are implemented as trees. If I take an example of the code we use, you have a list of cells, a list for the x coordinate, a list of y coordinate, a list of the v coordinate, a list of child, and a list of parent for each cell. These two columns are in fact a kind of handmade pointers. If you want to navigate through the tree, you may want to look to the child cell or to the parent cell. So there is a lot of computation time that are lost. There is a loss of computation time, which is due to indirections with this kind of things. In fact, every tree, or nearly every tree, can be written with no pointers by linearizing them, and by using hash maps. And with this kind of techniques, you can provide a single array with all your cells, and you can go through every cell in a contiguous way. So basically, if I want to write this kind of tree, I will need a list of index, which constitute the hash maps, and a list of data. In the case of a normal tree, I will have pointers and my list of data. So if I linearize my tree in the following way, all position and information are encoded in the index. So with that, I will have a low memory footprint because I have a lot of information encoded in the index. You can code and decode the hash using bit manipulation instructions that are now in the Intel and AMD set of instructions. If you choose carefully your indexing techniques, you can have an implicit space filling curve. You can have an arbitrary number of dimensions. And with that, you have a contiguous allocation of all your data. So using this kind of implicit trees, you will guarantee a data locality, you will guarantee high performance and simple parallelization of vectorization, because if I want to parallelize, I will just take a part of this array and put it and a different process. So the current work we are doing in our team using all these aspects. First, in the first aspect, we are trying currently to implement an implicit tree library with the same kind of approach like in the Boost Graph library. In the second part, it was my PhD work. In fact, I work on general relativity using this level 2 cinematic approach. And the third one, maybe we'll do it one day, and it would be the ideal thing in order to make ab initio cosmology, which are fully relativistic simulations. Currently, we don't have such a thing is way. Maybe in 2020 at the exascale era we will be able to do this kind of simulations. So to conclude, petascale computing has already shown some problems with today's scientific codes. Exascale will need a cultural change because the way we are implementing our codes today in the scientific community doesn't scale for very large code base. C++ allows to achieve both performance and genericity by making change in the compilation process itself. And using template metaprogramming allow us to code active library, which are library that will modify the user code, and allow to dissociate problems. So to summarize, in the past we had pure language implementation. Currently in scientific community we are using passive libraries, and maybe to achieve exascale we'll need active libraries who will modify the code the user wants to explore. Thank you for your attention. Any question?
So I think I can say this because I did spend some time a long time ago writing physics simulation codes, but do you think that the programming community within physics is ready for template metaprogramming?
That's a good question. I think that there are some people out there that are really interested in that, but for mainstream scientific programmers, it's far beyond what they can achieve, because in fact in the physics community programming is often seen as simply a tool in order to achieve something, but in fact as the complexity of our code grows, I think that these kind of techniques may become more and more mainstream one day.
I guess my experience is that most people in the physics community are more interested in the physics than they are in programming. Quite rightly so. I was sort of an exception when I was there. So maybe you need to put some consideration on making some of this more consumable for them, because you're still going to rely on them to take a lot of their knowledge and encode it within whatever framework they get given.
Yeah, but even if the library developer, you have to use template metaprogramming, for the users it's a kind of simple library and it doesn't need to have a deep understanding of what's happening in there.